Now I want to refute what the no jurisdiction position advocates say about consecrating bishops without a papal mandate. Their position is that it's never lawful to consecrate a bishop without a papal mandate. Here's how Jerry explains it.
You don't need a pope to come along and tell you otherwise when the popes of the past have already forbidden this. Pope Pius XII is quite explicit in legislation after legislation that anyone who consecrates a bishop without a papal mandate incurs automatic excommunication, is suspended from all priestly functions. And this is not talking about the minor excommunication that would still allow you to permit someone who is still a priest of the Catholic Church but undergoing minor excommunication.
Here's more on the same issue of consecrating bishops.
Kent has made the comment several times that laws do not bind when obedience to them is impossible. I agree with that principle. But it's irrelevant. It's true, but irrelevant, because it's not impossible to abide by this law. If canon law says that without a papal mandate, you can't consecrate a bishop, then it's perfectly possible to obey that law. You say, well, then I will not consecrate a bishop until I have the mandate that not only canon law, but divine law requires, because it is the teaching, the solemn dogmatic teaching of the Catholic Church at the Vatican Council of 1870, for example, that all jurisdiction resides ultimately in the Pope. And the Pope delegates this authority to the bishops of the world. And therefore, the jurisdiction which these bishops want to claim extraordinarily is not being derived from the proper source. They are starting from, it's like building a house with a second floor, no first floor, no foundation to hold it up. It just can't float there in the air. In other words, it's irrelevant for Ken to say over and over again, look, we can't obey these laws. Of course you can. You just don't make bishops until you have the authority of a pope telling you to. Why did the church give you that? Please read the commentaries on these laws.
Jerry says that it's perfectly possible to obey the law forbidding a consecration of a bishop without a papal mandate. You just don't consecrate bishops. Okay, canon law also says that you can't preach without permission. Don't preach! It's perfectly possible for you to obey that law and not preach, and stop your preaching all over the country. It's also perfectly possible for you to obey the law forbidding anyone to publish religious works without proper approval. You just don't publish religious works, but you do that anyway, even though it's possible for you to obey it. It also says in canon law that when you convert someone, you must bring him to the local ordinary so that he can make his profession of faith and abjuration there. But since there aren't any local ordinaries, that would mean that you couldn't convert anyone, because, according to the strict letter of canon law, you have to go to the ordinary. It's perfectly possible for you to obey that law. You just don't try to convert anyone, or you try to convert them and hope and pray that some ordinary comes along out of nowhere so that he can make his profession of faith to him. This is abominable hypocrisy. And before I get into refuting his false position on the consecration of bishops without papal mandate, I want to play another clip in which he invokes Epikaia and admits that when he thinks it's justifiable, it's okay to violate the very laws he claims are binding.
It's not canon law. Can you please tell us who received you back into the church and by what means? And can you please show us the imprimatur for all your published works and website?
What Ken has just done is point out something that we both agree in this debate. That obviously there is a legitimate application of the concept of epikaia that can be invoked. And I have a whole section on it in the handout there. Because obviously Ken can't show any imprimatur for his writing or his engaging the debate as well. Technically speaking, but if we follow the strict letter of the law, we cannot have a debate without the approval of a local ordinary. But we don't have a local ordinary to do so. In that case, however, canon law itself addresses that situation. It says that when the faith, and I have the quote here in the handout. Let me see here. I'll just read it right to you. Bad argument number 9. Jerry Maddox is such a hypocrite. What gives him, a mere layman, the right to give talks, especially talks or debates against the CMRI? And yet he has the audacity to argue that the clergy of the CMRI are not authorized to preach or otherwise function as clergy. Answer. Unlike the clergy of the CMRI, I do not violate the prescriptions of canon law in what I do. Canon 1325 explicitly says the faithful are bound to profess their faith publicly whenever silence, subterfuge, or their manner of acting would otherwise entail an implicit denial of their faith, a contempt of religion, an insult to God, or scandal of their neighbor. I concede that to Ken, to the clergy of the CMRI the same right to profess their Catholic faith. What I deny is their right to function as clergy, duly authorized by Holy Mother Church, any more than I would have the right to do so if I were to say, look, we don't have a priest in Scranton, Pennsylvania, where I live. I'm going to go find an old Catholic bishop, and I'm going to get him to ordain me a priest and a bishop, too. Maybe I can get him to do what Archbishop Took did when he ordained Clemente Domingo, bishop and priest and bishop in the same day, in contravention of all Catholic canon law and all Catholic history. Maybe I could do that because the salvation of my family requires it. No. We have a right to do certain things as lay people. We don't have the right to become clergy in ways that contradict the teaching of the Church.
If you listen carefully to this clip, you notice that there is a contradiction and dishonesty. He begins by saying, yes, we agree that there is a legitimate concept of epikaia, that he doesn't have an imprimatur, that he doesn't have approval for his published works. Therefore, he is violating the very canon laws which he wrongly claims are still in force and binding today. But then he tries to say that, unlike these other groups, I don't violate canon law in what I do. So which one is it? Do you invoke epikaia or not? And so he wants to admit when he's confronted that, yes, there is a legitimate concept of epikaia, but then try to give the impression that he is not violating canon law at all. It's purely dishonest. And so he draws a sharp line between what he does, preaching and publishing without permission, trying to convert people in a fashion that is not strictly in accord with canon law, since there is no ordinary, but says that, no, you can't ordain a priest, you can't consecrate a bishop for the salvation of souls so that they can hear the confessions of people, give sacraments to people, etc. And that simply does not follow. And as we've covered, there are many examples in church history where people who were not properly approved for either consecration of bishops or their ordinations acted validly. So I just wanted to point that out to show the profound hypocrisy and how, really, that question alone, the fact that he doesn't have permission for what he does, blows his whole argument out of the water. And I also wanted to mention just a quick point about this Ken. This is an individual whom we actually debated on Baptism of Desire that's on our website, and he admitted in the debate that he couldn't refute the arguments and changed his position, and so temporarily claimed to be in agreement with us. And he was also not really convinced on this jurisdiction position. He was sort of swinging back and forth or questioning it deeply, and he was reading our article, and I guess that helped persuade him, along with some other things. And so after really only being convinced of this jurisdiction position, the true position that these no jurisdiction advocates are completely wrong, for only a short time, he decided to debate Jerry. And in the course of the debate, or actually before the debate, he was calling us up and asking for help and assistance. And we presumed he was in agreement with us on the issues. But in the course of the debate, he wound up promoting many different heretical groups and some of the worst heretics in the traditional movement. So it was really awful. He did make a few valid points, such as that Jerry doesn't have any permission for what he does. But he neglected to mention almost all the other points that I've covered today, which totally devastate the position, such as the ones on the Great Western Schism, and also the points from Maskevich's book. And then after the debate, when we charitably rebuked him for promoting heretical groups and priests in the debate, he seemed to acknowledge that it was wrong, and seemed to change his position again. But a few weeks after that, he completely switched his position again on salvation, and unfortunately became a promoter of the heretical groups which favor salvation outside the church. And so, unfortunately, he's a mass of heretical contradictions. Now I want to cover in some detail the issue of consecrating a bishop without a papal mandate. All of the advocates of the no jurisdiction position cite Pope Pius XII in his encyclical from June 29, 1958, Ad Apostolorum Principis, which was about the consecrations in China without a papal mandate. In that encyclical, Pope Pius XII sternly condemned consecrating bishops in China without a papal mandate, and he made it an automatic excommunication for anyone who would do it without his approval. And so the advocates of the no jurisdiction position cite this and say, see, this is clear. This is a clear law that if you do this without permission, this is an automatic excommunication. And I'm always stunned by their bad will and their failure to understand when they cite this, because in the very same encyclical, And this is covered in our article on jurisdiction, which has been posted on our website for some years now, where we give the quotes from this very encyclical. Pius XII repeatedly mentions in this very encyclical that the issue of consecrating a bishop without a papal mandate is a disciplinary issue. It's not a dogma, contrary to what the schismatic Barbara Linneberg wrongly stated in her book. That means that it's a church law, just like it's a church law that in normal times you can't preach without approval, or you can't publish a religious work without approval. It's a church law. And they confuse the issue by saying that it's a dogma that the Pope has all jurisdiction in the church. That's true. But the issue of whether someone could ever consecrate a bishop without a papal mandate is not a dogma. Now I want to quickly give a few quotes from Pius XII's encyclical. From the aforementioned encyclical, paragraph 43, he speaks of those who try to justify their consecrations by, quote, recalling a usage which prevailed in ages past, end quote. So he admits that it wasn't always forbidden to consecrate a bishop without a papal mandate. And that's simply a fact. Anyone who studies early church history knows that many bishops were consecrated without the express approval of the Pope before he approved it, and often against his approval. That was going on all over the empire, different periods of church history. And the Pope didn't always immediately break off communion with those bishops. That's just a fact. And due to the inability to easily travel long distances and communicate with those who were very far away, the popes couldn't have been involved prior to all the consecrations of bishops. It just didn't happen. It's just a fact. And so it's a disciplinary issue. And on this point, I want to give another quote from Pope Pius IX in his encyclical, January 6, 1873, Quartus Supra number 34. Quote, "The Apostolic See has at times tolerated elected patriarchs using their power before being confirmed by the See," meaning the Pope. "It has done so because their districts were so distant, or because the journey was dangerous, or because of the reverses threatening more and more frequently from the predominance of schismatics of the same rite," end quote. So Pius IX simply acknowledges the fact that many bishops in church history were consecrated before the Pope even approved them. So consecrations without a papal mandate are a fact of history, and it's not a dogma, contrary to what some of these schismatics say, that you can't do it. Pius XII's legislation against what was going on in China was meant for that time. Yes, you should not do it against the direct will of the reigning and true Pope, obviously. He was not talking about a situation where there is no Pope, where all the ordinaries have vanished into apostasy. And in fact, in arguing this point, he even says this. This is from paragraph 50 of the same encyclical. Quote, "It is obvious that no thought is being taken of the spiritual good of the faithful if the church's laws are being violated. And further, there is no question of vacant sees, as they wish to argue in defense, but of episcopal sees whose legitimate rulers have been driven out or now languish in prison," end quote. And so Pius XII even explicitly acknowledges and implies that if there were a question of vacant sees, they might have a stronger argument. But he says that there is no question of vacant sees. Rather, it was a situation where there are legitimate bishops, but you're trying to usurp their offices against my will. He's not talking about a situation where there are no bishops, and you need a bishop to ordain a priest, and there is no pope, and there are no ordinaries. So it's completely beside the point. It's a terrible argument. It's just amazing how more people who read this encyclical do not see it. And I just wanted to give one more quote from the encyclical to further demonstrate the point. In paragraph 43, which we've already cited part of, he speaks of how they, quote, "indisputably prove that they follow this line deliberately in order to escape from the discipline which now prevails and which they ought to be obeying," end quote. So again, he says it in plain terms that it's a disciplinary issue which involves obedience to the Pope in the normal state of the Church's life. It's not in any way a proof that someone cannot consecrate a bishop without a papal mandate in a necessity such as the one we have now. So there are other points that could be raised on this matter, but I think that that is sufficient for someone of goodwill. Now I want to close out this audio series on jurisdiction by simply focusing in on the profound hypocrisy of the advocates of the no jurisdiction position. As we've mentioned, canon law teaches that one may not preach or publish religious works without the approval of the ordinary. In disseminating their false and schismatic view on jurisdiction, these people totally cast those laws aside and thus condemn themselves out of their own mouths. Here is Jerry Matetics admitting that to preach requires explicit jurisdictional authorization.
To preach, likewise, is something that requires explicit jurisdictional authorization. And I quote that as well here on this in this handout.
So he's obviously condemned out of his own mouth, but he actually tries to get around it by saying that he doesn't preach, he just talks and evangelizes. Well, that is patently ridiculous. And to further refute it, I want to examine what Pope Leo XIII said about this matter. In Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Sapienza Christiane of January 10, 1890, in Numbers 15 and 16, he says that the office of preaching is reserved for pastors. But he goes on to say what part the laity can have in preaching and or teaching in a less than official capacity. He says, quote, "No one, however, must entertain the notion that private individuals are prevented from taking some active part in this duty of teaching, especially those on whom God has bestowed gifts of mind. These, so often as circumstances demand, may take upon themselves, not indeed the office of the pastor, but the task of communicating to others what they have themselves received, becoming, as it were, living echoes of their masters in the faith." End quote. And so, yes, the laity can evangelize, the laity can repeat what they've learned, but in normal times, under the strict letter of canon law, they cannot do what Jerry Matetics is doing. He is not, as Pope Leo XIII says, simply repeating what he has received. No, what he is saying has never been explicitly taught by any pope. No pope has ever said, you can't go here, you can't go here, you must believe this about this situation in this group. These are all his own personal conclusions. And so it's not equivalent to simply repeating what he's received and then directing them to the pastor, which is what the laity could do in a normal situation, and evangelizing his neighbor by directing him to the pastor. But no, rather he's coming up with his own views, publishing all kinds of works, holding a worldwide preaching apostolate. So the notion that he is just talking, not preaching, is completely dishonest and ridiculous. Furthermore, even if we granted his argument, which we don't, it's absurd, he publishes without approval, so he violates the canon law there. Canon 1385.1 and 2 forbids laymen to publish works on theology, scripture, canon law, etc., without approval from the ordinary. They completely ignore that, cast it aside. Not just Jerry, but most of these no jurisdiction advocates. And Jerry, as I mentioned already, shows his profound dishonesty because he wants to act like he's not violating any of the laws, but then, talking out of the other side of his mouth, says that, well, yes, I do invoke epikaia in a certain limited circumstance. And he further contradicts himself because at one point he said that epikaia does not supply jurisdiction. It does not apply to the external forum. While he invoked epikaia to justify his publishing without permission. We need to also mention that Canon 755.1 of the 1917 Code states that baptism is to be performed solemnly, that is, with all the proper ceremonies, except in danger of death. And Canon 757.1 states that the priest must use solemnly blessed baptismal water. Private baptisms by lay people are only allowed in danger of death, according to 759.1. So the point here is that according to the strict letter of canon law, you cannot even baptize your children unless it's done solemnly with all the proper ceremonies. Since they are not approved priests and cannot supply all of the proper ceremonies and the blessed holy water, their own position, adhering to the strict letter of canon law in this situation, would cause them to conclude that they cannot baptize anyone until danger of death. I mean, I don't know what else illustrates that their position is a position of the devil. Under the pretext of adherence to canon law, they would have people go through their entire lives unbaptized and thus outside the church and under the dominion of the devil, even though they wanted to convert. It's a position of schism. It's a position of pharisaical nonsense, which springs from pride and a misunderstanding and misapplication of church laws intended for a normal situation. Another law that needs to be mentioned in this context is Canon 23.14.2, which states that a juridical abjuration is done in the presence of the local ordinary or his delegate and at least two witnesses. Abjuration must be done in the form of the Roman ritual. And so abjuration is what was done when someone's converted from heresy. And so if they're going to try to convert people, and Jerry and these other people claim to try to convert people, according to the strict letter of canon law, they couldn't do it, because in order for him to make the proper abjuration and profession of faith, canon law says he must go to the ordinary or his delegate and do it there. But they say, no, that doesn't apply because this is a different situation. Exactly. You again condemn yourself out of your own mouth, and you show that your position is schismatic and of the devil. Now, some of these no jurisdiction position schismatics only make these arguments with reference to the 1917 code. Others, such as the schismatic Lineberg, she will cite past laws from other councils whose ecclesiastical laws intended for those time periods have long been revoked or fallen out of a binding nature. And that is even more absurd, because there are all kinds of laws from councils, such as how when people would get married, it would have to be announced in advance by the pastor in the church. Here's a quote from the Fourth Lateran Council under Pope Innocent III, Constitution 51, quote, "We decree that when marriages are to be contracted, they shall be publicly announced in the churches by priests. If any persons presume to enter into clandestine marriages, the offspring of the union shall be deemed illegitimate." And so it wasn't considered a legitimate marriage unless that announcement had been made. That means that, according to their position, no one can be legitimately married today, which is completely absurd. The truth is that these are laws which were promulgated for that period. They are disciplinary laws for that situation. And of course, there are the church laws that you have to receive Holy Communion once a year. As the Catechism of Trent points out, quote, "The Council of Lateran therefore decreed that all the faithful should receive the body of the Lord at least once a year at Easter, and that neglect of this duty should be chastised by exclusion from the society of the faithful," end quote. So according to the strict letter of that law, these people who don't receive communion once a year are outside the faithful. They're outside the church. But they say, no, that doesn't bind. That was revoked. It doesn't apply. Exactly. You just make the point again. And so their hypocrisy is stunning and abominable. And ironically, these very same people trample upon the divine law and allow violations of the divine law and God's dogmas, which are binding and do matter in this situation and in every situation. They accept heresies against the dogma, outside the church there is no salvation, and they accept people as Catholic who reject that dogma, as proven by our discussion of Jerry's acceptance of such individuals as Catholics. And so they've fallen into a clear snare of the devil. As a result of their failure to really believe in God and stand for his truths, the devil has them binding things that aren't binding and ignoring the things that are binding. The problem with these different groups, such as the CMRI and these other independent groups who are offering traditional masses, is not that they want to spread the traditional mass. It's not that they want to say traditional masses. It's that they deny the dogma, outside the church there is no salvation, and accept natural family planning. Those are the primary problems. They're problems dealing with faith. And so the no jurisdiction Pharisees condemn these groups for what is not their problem, namely having priests ordained so that they can hear people's confessions, say masses in the traditional form, administer traditional sacraments, etc. They condemn them for that, but they ignore what is truly their problem, that they do not accept the absolute necessity of water baptism and the necessity of the Catholic faith for salvation, and the fact that they accept natural family planning. So they condemn them for what is not their problem, wanting to spread the traditional mass, wanting to administer traditional sacraments, but for the most part neglect their violations of what really matters, the faith. And the faith is what people need for salvation. That's what they need to be saved, and that's why these jurisdictional Pharisees are so deceived. And what our Lord said to the Pharisees applies to them. Matthew 23:23, quote, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you tithe mint and anise and cummin, and have left the weightier things of the law, judgment and mercy and faith. These things you ought to have done, and not to leave those undone." End quote. And they are exactly what our Lord spoke of in the Gospel when he condemned the Pharisees. For instance, in Matthew chapter 12, we read about how when Jesus went through the corn on the Sabbath and his disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck the ears and to eat because they felt they needed the food. And the Pharisees, seeing them, said to them, "Behold, thy disciples do that which is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." But Jesus said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, and they that were with him, how he entered into the house of God and did eat the loaves of proposition, which it was not lawful for him to eat, nor for them that were with him, but for the priests only? Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath days the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are without blame? But I tell you that here is a greater than the temple." End quote. And so Jesus condemned the Pharisees for binding things that do not bind in certain circumstances and in a necessity. And that's the principle of canon law, that necessity can make licit that which is normally illicit. And I think it's important to close with something that we read about in the book of 1 Maccabees. In 1 Maccabees, we read that some of the Jews made a mistake which is similar, though not quite as absurd, to what the advocates of the no jurisdiction position argue. In the Maccabees, the resisting Israelites were attacked on the Sabbath because the allies of evil King Antiochus didn't believe that they would fight back on the Sabbath. At first, the Jews, the resistors, did not fight back on the Sabbath because they believed it would be unlawful. Or, if you prefer to translate that into language for our times, they did not say Mass, they did not hear confessions, they did not consecrate bishops, they did not ordain priests, because they believed it was unlawful. But after their people were all being slain, the Maccabees changed their course and did fight back on the Sabbath. 1 Maccabees 2:32 and following, quote, "And forthwith they, the allies of King Antiochus, went out towards them and made war against them on the Sabbath. But they, the resisting Israelites, answered them not, neither did they cast a stone at them, nor stopped up the secret places because it was the Sabbath, saying, Let us all die in our innocency. And heaven and earth shall be witnesses for us that you put us to death wrongfully. So they, the allies of the evil King Antiochus, gave them battle on the Sabbath, and they, the resisting Israelites, were slain, with their wives, and their children, and their cattle, to the number of 1,000 persons. And every man said to his neighbor, If we shall do as our brethren have done, and not fight against the heathens for our lives, and our justifications, they will now quickly root us out of the earth. And they determined in that day, saying, Whosoever shall come up against us to fight on the Sabbath day, we will fight against him, and we will not all die as our brethren that were slain in the secret places." End quote.